Welcome to I Want That, which is a podcast that focuses on the ever-evolving world of Disney merch. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and you are?
I'm entertainment writer Michelle Valladolid.
And look, folks, I know it's been a while since we posted a new episode of the show. The fall of 2019 was challenging, to say the least. But now it's January of 2020, the start of a brand new year, and Michelle and I are recording this show on the evening of Monday, January 6th. And Michelle, you wanted to start things off by talking about, merch related to the Walt Disney World Marathon Weekend
right? Presented by Cigna at Disney Springs. They've got some really great merchandise and some food, too. Heavy on the carbs, of course. But if you go to Joffrey's Coffee, you can get a special little Run Mickey decal, powder decal on top of your coffee. But all sorts of places have the, because you know it's all about the food, Jim, have extra carbs for you. But there's some really cute, there's a first-time marathoner, these pretty blue mouse ear cap. And some wall art. There's even a Christmas ornament, even though Christmas just finished. This says Dopey Challenge 2020 on it, and it's shaped like Mickey ears. They put gold balls together. Magic bands, phone cases, frames, finisher ear hats, custom phone cases and magic bands. Just all sorts of things to celebrate if you are running this weekend. Or if you want to pretend that you ran this weekend.
We don't endorse that, but okay. No, that's cool.
If you collect Run cool Disney stuff.
This is true. This is true. And in fact, you know, I think I've shared the story about Arlen Miller and I were there on the morning of the very first Walt Disney World Marathon. And we were standing next to all of the medals, and we were so well behaved. We didn't take one. seriously, there was a giant stack of them. That story for another time. And the weekend after the Walt Disney World Marathon, we have the start of the fourth annual Epcot
International Festival of the Arts. And there's some great stuff. There is so much.
There is
so much art. Dave Perillo, he did those Epcot posters at D23 and at the Epcot Preview Center, and he's got one for Kitchen Cabaret that is on my to get list. Jared Mariama's there with his cute stuff. June Kim has some Orange Bird stuff. You know how I love the Orange Bird.
Okay, not to interrupt here.
Yeah.
But again, before we do the punch list, as in what people should be looking for from what artists, just a little history about Festival of the Arts. Face it, you know, what was it? The very first Flower and Garden was held back in April of 1994. And then, Festival of the Holidays, as we know it today, started in November of that same year, and that was because they moved the candlelight procession. From the Magic Kingdom to the American Garden Theaters, and then Food and Wine started in October of 1995. So inside of like one 18-month long period, you know, you had three of the things that really make up what we know, you know, or the way we think of Epcot today appeared, but there was always this chunk of time between January and mid-February, early March.
Before spring break.
You know, that's when, but also before Flower and Garden got underway.
Oh, that's true.
With the thinking that, you know, we really need something else to get folks in here. And for a time, one of the ideas they were kicking around was a science-based festival that would be held primarily in World Showcase. The interesting thing is that this wasn't the first time that Disney had done something at Epcot that would be primarily staged in Future World. They had, the Epcot Center Daredevil Circus Spectacular, which they set up a temporary stage on top of the fountain at the center of Communicore,
right.
And, you know, had them perform there. There was also, for a time in the mid-90s, they had a robotics competition, you know, with the idea that the regionals were held all over the country, but the finals were actually held at Epcot.
Now, do you remember the other thing they tried before the science?
Nope.
The doll and teddy bear convention.
Oh, God, yes.
Where they introduced the Disney bear. He had no name.
Yeah, you know, wasn't that the one where they made a billion of, what's her name? The one, Teddy Bear.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had this beautiful bear of Teddy Bear.
I don't know what happened to it.
Yeah.
Sands of time.
Yeah, I remember going to the factory outlet and they had like a solid wall of Teddy Bears because they hadn't sold. But anyway, the pivot back to this is the special events group trying to decide what to do to fill that hole in the schedule. And about the same time, you know, they are developing the new plan for Epcot and the whole notion that Future World will now become three different neighborhoods, World Celebration, World Nature, and World Discovery. And so obviously with all that going on and all the you know, reimagining of, you know, interventions in the old Community Core buildings and that sort of thing, it just didn't make sense to do anything in the Future World section. So that's where the Festival of the Arts came from. And also, to be frank, you were just talking about, you know, it's all about the food. And they had started converting a lot of those temporary food kitchens, you know, that are around World Showcase, into permanent installations,
right.
You know, permanent open kitchens. And so it's like, well, look, we got the infrastructure. You know, we really should do something around World Showcase Lagoon. So, but they weren't entirely confident in the Festival of the Arts idea, which was why when it debuted in 2017, it wasn't a week-long event. It ran for, I want to say, 3 weekends. And even then, it was only Friday to Monday. And what? It was built around three different artistic disciplines, culinary, visual, and performing arts.
Correct.
And so, but you know, clearly caught on, and now here we are in its fourth year. It's running all the way from January 17th through February 24th. And as you mentioned, there's 28 different artists who have created pieces.
Kevin John did two amazing pieces for It's a Small World. And then Mercadata does one that's called Think Tiki Thoughts, and it's the Tiki Birds plus the Orange Bird, who is singing a tune.
Yeah, I have to admit that's a strong piece of art. The panty that Rob Kaz created of Figment sort of hovering over Spaceship
Looking
Earth.
Looking at the fireworks, that's the just, oh.
Yeah, that's kind of a must-have. On the other hand, given that I'm such a big fan of the Mickey shorts that Paul Reddish and his crew do, Joe Kaminsky's fist bump and taking a stance with Mickey,
right.
Those are fun as well.
Yeah, his Cindy and Yes Dear of Bambi are cute too.
This is true.
But yeah,
what do you think of Jason Pell's stuff? You know those where you can make the face on your phone or a face on your phone talk like you're talking?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, you know what? I thought more about the marquees that used to appear in front of the old Mickey films, cartoons.
This is true. Well, I got to say the Stitch Starburst and the Genie Starburst are wonderful. You know, really
I like
wouldn't
the
mind.
Orange Bird,
you know,
one.
Again, you and Orange Bird.
Not like Orange Bird.
What?
On the other hand,
someone not like Orange Bird?
He
is no longer associated with Anita Bryant, Jim.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that he is so, you know, again, he was created for the Florida Orange Growers Association when Disney was trying to convince them to sponsor the Sunshine. In fact,
it worked.
That's the other thing. It's not the Enchanted Tiki Room. It was the Sunshine Pavilion because, again, Sunshine, Florida Sunshine, orange juice. You know, they did everything and again, his head is an orange.
I know.
All right, it's like how much
That's
thought
so cute.
Did you put into
and the little leaves?
Anyway, look, if you want to talk cute, for me, cute is Darren Wilson's Stitch Mad Hatter. You know or for that matter, you know that if you want
Gabby Zapata's everything.
Well, actually, but Gabby Zapata's young Carl and Ellie from Up.
Yeah.
You know, oh, that's a heartbreaker. You know, Ashley Taylor's. Yeah. Yeah. She's got that wonderful sort of multiple settings from Alice in Wonderland that, you know, just kind of knocked your eyes out.
It's almost like one of those ride murals.
And Didi Chahani's, there's a wonderful piece, two pieces she's done, the Mulan on horseback and baby Moana cuddling with her grandmother in the surf. Both are beautiful pieces.
And Jason Ratner's stuff like June... is really yeah. great. Got a lot of details in there and lots of little hidden things to look for in there. And he actually, if you go to Twitter to at J-J-A-Y Ratner, or J-A-Y-R-A-T-N-E-R, at J Ratner, mm-hmm. he's actually got his schedule that up there on Twitter.
Oh. You know, the nice thing about this event is you can buy these pieces and you can get them signed by the artist. Now, I have to caution here. In fact, on the PDF that you can download, in fact, that's Michelle and I have been consulting that as we've been chatting about the pieces that are available at this year's Epcot International Festival of the Arts. Multiple times, they list that warning, merchandise available while supplies last.
Right.
Also, likely a lot of these pieces are going to be pricey. And you know, makes you kind of wish that you could take all those gift cards that, you know, you got over Christmas and apply them to, you know, to paying off these things.
You can.
If you get Disney cards. if, on the other hand, you're stuck with Amazon cards. Michelle and I actually have a recommendation, by the way, if you have some leftover Amazon cards. And this comes by way of a family friend, Gina Marie, and her husband, Alex, who have been enjoying the Disney Villainous. This is a strategic tabletop board game that Wonderforge created.
Yeah, I hear nothing but good things about it. Sometime when I have a clear table, I'll play it.
Okay. Well, it's got kind of a unique idea. The idea is that each player gets to play a different Disney villain. And there's a slogan on the outside of the box that says, "The worst takes it all," which kind of sums up what Disney Villainous is about. So, original version of the game, your choices of characters are Captain Hook from Peter Pan, Prince John from Robin Hood, the Queen of Hearts from Alice in Wonderland, Maleficent from
Sleeping Beauty,
Ursula the Sea Witch from Little Mermaid, and finally Jafar from Aladdin. And what's kind of interesting about this game is that each villain has a different objective that they're trying to achieve over the course of the game. And what's kind of cool is this objective is basically the exact same thing that the character wanted in the film that they came from. And whoever manages to achieve that, whether it's, you know, Jafar becoming Sultan on High, or, you know, the Ursula, you know, getting the trident and the crown and becoming controlling all of the seas. Once you achieve that, you win. And what's especially fun about this game, which, by the way, is for suitable for players 10 and up, is that you're given fate cards. So if, for example, you know, someone across the table is that much closer to winning than you are, you can deal them a fate card and, you know, knock them back a few pegs, you know, that set them back in their quest. This game hit the market back in 2018, became hugely popular, and wound up winning Game of the Year at last year's Toy of the Year Awards.
You're right.
And when you have a success, you capitalize on it. So Wonderforge has put out two expansion packs, a Wicked to the Core, where you get to play as Dr. Facilier from Princess and the Frog, Hades from Hercules, or the Evil Queen from Snow White. There's also the Evil Comes Prepared edition of the game, where you can play... And I love this one in particular because Professor Radigan from The Great Mouse Detective.
I love
and
Radigan.
Yzma. Yeah, Yzma from Emperor's New Groove, uh-huh. and of course, then Scar
Wrong
from
Lever.
Lion King. The other thing that, frankly, is really impressive about the Disney Villainous games is they're beautifully designed. They've got, for example, wonderfully stylized game pieces that are kind of abstract in design, but they immediately get across, you know, who the character is. In fact, it's so funny. If you know Robin Hood and you know Prince John, the crown that he wears in the film is so distinct that, as I was just doing the research in the game, and before I even knew Prince John was in the game, I saw this bright yellow piece with the crown on it. And it's like, wow, that looks like Prince John's crown from Robin Hood. And sure enough, he was in the game. The game pieces are so beautifully designed and so on model from the Disney films that what's this weird kind of offshoot for the game. Ravensburger AG, which is the market leader for European jigsaw puzzles, they've created this set of 1,000-piece puzzles, which is made up entirely of this great on-model character art that Wonderforge created for each of the Disney villains from the first edition of Disney Villainous. So there's a 1,000-piece puzzle for Ursula, Captain Hook, Jafar, Queen of Hearts, Maleficent, and Prince John. And these things are, honestly, when they're completely disassembled, they're so handsome. You're going to want to hang them on your wall. Now, mind you, Ravensburger hasn't done jigsaw puzzles yet for the expansion sets, The Evil Comes Prepared or Wicked to the Core. But it's worth noting that both of those expansion games actually are perfectly playable as standalone games all by themselves.
Oh, wow.
But on the other hand, you can then mix them into the original Worst Takes at All. So, again, thanks to Alex and Gina for sort of putting this on my radar. And like I said, well worth, if you got some Amazon, gift cards lying around, snagging you one or two of these.
Now, if you have Disney gift cards, there are also workshops that you can do. Mm-hmm. And one of them is Disney 3D Paper Crafting with Dave Avanzino. And that's Sunday, January 19th. Right now it is showing as sold out, but there might be standby available, so double check. This is the guy who does that great paper craft with the
they're wonderful
mostly
pieces.
Letters and words. Just amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm. Loved going into the Disney gallery and seeing Dave's stuff on display there. Anyway, we were talking about Maleficent just a while back there, the villain from Sleeping Beauty. Disney Studios celebrated the 60th anniversary of the release of that full-length animated feature just last year, which initially arrived in theaters back in January 29th, 1959 to be exact. To me, to think that Disney actually celebrates this film, because let's be honest here, anybody who knows their Disney history, Michelle, knows that Walt Disney Animation Studios was never the same after Sleeping Beauty came out.
Right.
It was, the first ever Disney film to be done in, I want to get this name right because it's so stupid, Super Technorama 70mm widescreen. In order to do an animated film in that format, Sleeping Beauty was, moved very slowly through the production process, was, ridiculously expensive. The studio spent $6 million back in the 1950s, which was a huge amount of money. And the film actually lost money on its initial theatrical release, so much so that Walt Disney Studios had a huge layoff in 1959. And I've always heard them say...
From what you hear from people, these are things that only happen post-Eisner.
And that's an excellent point. But as Natalie Holt reveals in her new book, The Queens of Animation, The Untold Story of the Women Who Transformed the World of Disney and Made Cinematic History, that Little Brown published that back in October of last year. She's the first person I've ever seen put a number on how many people lost their jobs, Michelle. And she's got it that the studio fired all but 75 of the 550 artists and animators who were working at Disney at that time.
Whoa!
And worse, she's got, this direct quote from the book. It was the 9 old men who went through the records of the animation department and decided which lucky artists could stay and which had to leave.
Oh!
And that's the thing. You and I went to Mark and Atlas Davis's house multiple times and talked to them about all sorts of topics. I don't remember this ever coming up.
No.
But the other thing, frankly, again, that Sleeping Beauty lost over $1 million during its original theatrical release. And, you know, so again, for me, it's kind of startling that this is a film that the studio would even circle back on, let alone celebrate. And clearly, there were a lot of people at the studio who were sensitive about Sleeping Beauty. It sat in the vault. After its release in February of 1959, it didn't go back out into theaters again till June of 1970, so more than a decade. It was re-released again in September of 79, a third time in March of 86.
And that's when I saw it for the first time.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay, because I've been trying to, they also mentioned it was released in 1995 theatrically, and I can't pin down when that was exactly. But
it was one of Disney's first films that was released on Betamax.
So
87, 88 or so, maybe 89.
So maybe this is one of the films they learned the hard way that you couldn't re-release a film to theaters after it had been on, VHS and beta. That the audience, that suddenly the 7 year re-release every 7 years plan wasn't going to work now that they were on VHS and beta.
Yeah.
But again, supposedly it was only after the 1995 release that Sleeping Beauty finally officially turned a profit.
Wow.
And which reminds me, there's this story I love about Walt, that that interview he did with Peter Martin in the summer of 1956. This was for a series of articles that would eventually appear in the Saturday Evening Post, but it's a lot of the stories that we attribute to to Walt today, the Daddy's Day story about going to the carousel and Griffith Park and that sort of thing. These actually came out of that interview session with Pete Martin.
Okay.
And so, Walt's sitting at his desk and he's talking with Pete, but he's also going through his inbox. He looks at a report and literally in the middle of it goes, "Son of a bitch, Fantasia's finally in the black." And, but again, like Sleeping Beauty, the original Fantasia came out in November of 1940, and it took three re-releases, January of 42, September of 46, and finally February of 1956, before Disney's infamous concert feature finally managed to eke out a profit. So, again, in a lot of ways, Disney had an advantage when they could do this, when they could take their films out of the vault and re-release them. That even a film that didn't necessarily, make any money or recover all of its costs during its initial theatrical run, you could put it out a few more times and eventually get there. But back to Sleeping Beauty now. The film's title character literally is a snooze. I mean, it just she's my least favorite Disney princess because she does nothing. Just what? She dances with owls. It's that was the first draft of Dancing with Wolves. Maleficent, on the other hand, she built up quite the fandom over the past 50, 60 years. And
well, that's part of the genius of Mark Davis.
And what's interesting, I was just reading about Mark working on Maleficent, and what Mark realized is what really made her scary was stillness.
Yeah.
That, the fact that, Maleficent would, that they would often just stand still and other characters would react to her.
She never really screamed or shouted or anything until the very end.
No, that's it exactly. But at the same time, just to think about how he followed that movie with Cruella de Vil, and Cruella never stands still. No. She's always on the move. But again, that was the thing with Mark. He took this almost granular approach to each character and arrived at, the best way to do, its performance to make, that character have the greatest impact. But built up such a fandom that come May of 2014, we got the live action, kind of Disney's version of Wicked, where we get the backstory of why Maleficent was the way she was. And that did surprisingly well when it was out in theaters. It made $750 million, so much so it got its own sequel, Maleficent Mistress of Evil, which arrived in theaters October of last year. The sequel wasn't necessarily the equal as far as ticket sales.
It premiered on the ship when Alice and I were on our four-night Disney Dream Cruise.
Really?
Yes.
So they're on the boat while you're out on the water?
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Isn't that cool? The same moment that it premiered on land, it premiered at sea.
That would have been lovely to see it under those circumstances, especially
in the theater. I actually went in and watched a little bit of it, but just a few minutes because we were so busy doing everything else. I saw at least part of it.
When everything was totaled up, ticket sales for Maleficent, $490 million worldwide. So roughly, you know, it did about two-thirds of the business of the original Maleficent. And, you know, the merch program to support Mistress of Evil was a little interesting.
Freaky. I have less than 2 feet away from me a bath bomb with Maleficent horns on it.
Okay.
I had surgery. I'm not allowed to take a bath. But when I'm allowed to take a bath, I'm going to use that sucker.
And so getting into a bathtub with something that's sharp and pointy.
It's okay. Round. It has them imprinted into them.
Oh, my mistake. Okay. I don't know. It's just the entire merchandise program for Maleficent Mistress of Evil, it's kind of interesting. They've got a couple of jewelry pieces that have Maleficent's horned headpiece. There's a I Run This Castle pajama set, a Curses Don't End, They Break t-shirt, a sequin cap that features Maleficent's horns. The one piece that I came across, we visited the Disney store for their twice-a-year sale after Christmas, and do you know that Disney Animators collection, the one that sort of reimagines all the princesses as toddlers?
Yes, I do.
They've got I guess out ahead of the release of Maleficent Mistress of Evil, Disney's Consumer Products had a vinyl figure created of Maleficent, but again, done in the style of the Disney Animator collection. So it's a Mistress of Evil, but is a toddler.
Right, but remember, they also have the blanket baby of Maleficent.
Do they really?
Yeah, you know those stuffed animals that have the little blanket that wraps around them and they're Disney characters as toddlers? They have a Maleficent one, a baby Maleficent. And it's very green and adorable. Mean, kind of creepy.
I was about to say that nothing quite says that I think well of you and your baby. Like, here, put this in the crib with them. I'm sure they'll be fine. By the way, we're talking about Maleficent Mistress of Evil. The Blu-ray, DVD, and digital code version of that goes on sale January 14th. And again, I didn't get to see this film when it was out in theaters, but FedEx delivered my review copy earlier today, and I promise I'll take a look, see it.
You will. At fairly you will shortly. Hate Michelle Pfeiffer in 12 different ways when you see this, because she did such a good job.
Interesting. Okay.
She's awful. I mean, she does a great job. Her performance is okay,
but what won't be awful is the stories we'll share on the second half of the show, which we'll get to after this commercial break. Okay, following the world's worst transition to a commercial. We were just talking about January 17th. And again, that's the opening day of the International Festival of the Arts at Epcot. But that's not the only thing that's going on that day. That's also the day that Star Wars Rise of the Resistance opens at Disneyland Park.
Hello, baby.
So are we going to try to be there for opening day? What is the plan, Michelle?
You know, my invitation got lost in the mail again.
Well,
ever since I started writing for Mice Chat, they keep getting lost in the mail.
Okay. It's any consolation, I'm not getting invites either, but that's because I'm working with Mr. Testa these days. But that's okay. You know, that
Lynn's a good guy. He's worth it.
Okay, face it. Given the huge crowds that we have been seeing in Florida, you know, those folks standing on, you know, Hollywood Boulevard face down on their phones at 7 o'clock in the morning trying to get boarding groups. you got to assume we're going to see something similar happen in Anaheim. Now, mind you, you know,
dogs
Disneyland
and cats living together, mass hysteria.
There you go. Thank you, Ghostbusters. look, you know, but look, the Disneyland Resort has been getting ready for this. They actually began prepping as far out as 2017.
Right.
That's
Project
when
Stardust.
Got underway with widening sidewalks and removing curbs. In fact,
turning stores into restaurant seating and stroller parking. Mm-hmm. Like they did in Adventureland, just amazing stuff.
The Tomorrowland entrance thing, that's still ongoing,
yeah,
right?
It's still, all the french fries are gone.
Ah, there we go.
I was just reading about it on Mice Chat this morning. They took down the scrims and the sculptures at the entrance of Tomorrowland are fully restored and silver and beautiful.
Wow. Okay.
People were afraid they were going to take them out or paint them purple or something, but no, they really did a beautiful job.
Wow, I'll have to go check that out.
Definitely.
And let's be honest here.
We miss you.
Not all of the prep work for Star Wars Galaxies was actually done inside of Disneyland Park. Back in February of 2018, we actually got them beginning work on a reimagining of the World of Disney store out in downtown Disney Anaheim. With the idea of reconfiguring the store so it had a far more open atmosphere with some unique themed areas. And that brand new version of the World of Disney opened on October 26th of 2018. And one day later, on the exact opposite side of the country in Orlando, World of Disney store at Disney Springs reopened October 27th, 2018. And weird. It also closed in February in sort of a phased format for this reimagining. And I couldn't help but think of you, Michelle, because remember back when you covered the press event.
The 25th anniversary.
For the 21st anniversary of Walt Disney World. One of the things they did is they walked you folks through the still under construction World of Disney at downtown at downtown Disney. Do you remember what that was like? Or?
Not much. I remember really being impressed with all the steampunk looking artwork that they had and the theming of each room. That the villains were given the treasure room with all of the expensive jewelry and such, and things like that. To be honest, I like it better now. It's easier to find things. And I think you told me a story about people in ECVs. Am I right?
Yeah. In fact, the new design of both of the World of Disney's, to a lesser extent, the work that was recently done at Mickey's of Hollywood at Disney's Hollywood Studios, they really simplified the design, and more to the point, they really cleaned out the aisles to make it that much easier for guests who travel through the parks in ECVs to negotiate the stores and to be able to view the merchandise. That this evidently was something that they got a lot of guest letters about. They got complaints at guest relations. And, you know, with this recent set of redos, they decided to address that issue. But to pivot back to World of Disney for just a little bit here, again, when that opened to the public in October of 1996, this, again, the world's largest the largest character shop in the world, right? 51,000 square feet. The Anaheim version, which opened in February of 2001 as part of California Adventure, slightly smaller, 40,000 square feet. And, you know, what's kind of interesting is you mentioned the steampunk thing, that they had these, on the outside of the building, they had all of those airships that were piloted by, Mickey and Minnie and Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and I want to say the nephews?
Yeah.
Am I
Huey, Dewey, and Louie.
Okay, and then inside the building, they also had eight other fantasy airships. In fact, I was kind of surprised today when I was doing my due diligence out ahead of recording the show to see
one of
John Smith from Pocahontas He piloted an airship inside the building.
He did?
I don't think... there's a photo. He must have
okay.
done it.
I don't remember that. But
yeah, so they
were... I never saw World of Disney completed at Walt Disney World, only at Disneyland.
Yeah, because as described here, some of there were 8 fantasy airships inside the building. Some of them were as big or as long as 20 feet in length. And again, there were 10 different themed rooms. The magic room with sleepwear, the big, they referred to it as the Great Hall and the Rotunda, which I think you may recall that in addition to the airships, they had this artwork, that went around the ceiling.
Yeah. That's some beautiful artwork.
Mickey.
My favorite was the map Mickey room.
The map room was what? Where the paper was. Stationery, Disney souvenirs, that sort of thing.
Stuff you put on your desk. Had to change that map several times over the past few years.
Did they?
By 25. Yeah, because they had Mickey heads wherever there was a Disney park. Tokyo and Los Angeles and Florida and the newest one in France.
I had forgotten about that. Some of these rooms, I guess to the right of the map room was the bird room, which I guess because it's woman's apparel, I didn't spend much time in there. But the villains room, I always loved going in the villains room because of the watch cases that were shaped like the crocodile.
You know how when you get off the Doom Buggy at the Haunted Mansion, they have those arms that hold out and hold the candles? Like from the old Beauty and the Beast.
Those were in there.
They had things like that, but they had watches on and stuff.
You know, when they began thinking about redoing the World of Disney, as far out as 2016, 2017, they began designing and developing, a new look. And
it's supposed to be like a train station?
I've heard that story.
And I saw some of the signage, and I was
okay, is it supposed to be a train station in Orlando and a bus station in Anaheim? I think it's supposed to be a train station in both.
Maybe bus station in Orlando. They've got so many dang buses there.
Well, Alicia Kelly, who's the vice president of visual merchandising and location strategy at the Walt Disney Parks and Resorts, she talked about the redo of the World of Disney. And she said that we saw World of Disney as an opportunity to reimagine what Disney retail is today. The new store design highlights the best of what is current and new, but also celebrates classic Disney heritage based on storytelling. And, honestly, what they did here is they decided that the airships and, the very busy earlier design with the 10 different rooms, it was distracting. It was just disorienting.
There's 8 different dead ends.
Well, you got in there this past trip, right? What did you think of the revamped World of Disney?
Well, actually, I didn't get in, but I can tell you what I think of the one at Disneyland.
Okay.
Which, I love it. I love it. You can see across the store. I can find Noah anywhere. And I really love that they moved in the magic pictures from the cruise ships, that they have those there on the
this
walls.
Is true.
And they have...
But that's it. That's it, exactly.
They have some nice homages Disney history.
What they went with here is... they describe it as an open, loft-style atmosphere with great visibility. So, in theory, a guest can see a product from across the room fall in love and go buy it. But the very thing you described, the magic pictures or... the cash wraps, supposedly the idea with the cash wrap is that each of them is one of the animation desks that one of the 9 old men used.
Right.
And that if you go up to it, they have drawings of the characters that they did. So obviously the Mark Davis one would be one to seek out because, between Maleficent, Cruella, Alice, Cinderella, Thumper, there'd be a lot going on there. Now we talked earlier, we kind of teased what's going on at Disney's Hollywood Studios, because again, they also were getting their own Galaxy's Edge, And they felt that they needed, like Disneyland, to sort of retool their retail setup. So starting back in February of this year, or just this past year, 2019, the Planet Hollywood Superstore that was there on Sunset closed. And the reason they did that is they were looking to, they'd long had plans to expand into the Legends of Hollywood.
I didn't hear anything about any last day meetup or anything for that. That's kind of unusual.
Face it, the Planet Hollywood got that store on Sunset Boulevard is kind of a gimme for agreeing to build their Planet Hollywood restaurant right next door to Pleasure Island.
Right.
You know, again, didn't that open in 96 as well? Yeah. December of 96.
Yeah.
Anyway. March 1st of 2019, Keystone Clothiers and Legend of Hollywood's closed. And then on May 14th, Mickey's of Hollywood, that theme park's equivalent of the Emporium closes. And then August 23rd, Legends of Hollywood reopens with, as we mentioned, the ECV-friendly design with, cleaner, wider aisles. Easier, for folks to negotiate or just to actually see the merch they want to buy.
Yeah, we went in there, looked at some dresses and things, and it's nice and wide open and clean, and you can find stuff easily.
Well, but the one that I love, the really smart thing that they did was Keystone Clothiers, which opened on August 29th, which would coincidentally, or not so coincidentally, the exact same day that Galaxy's Edge opened at Disney's Hollywood Studios.
Right.
And what they've done there is, to my way of thinking, at least from a merch point of view, is brilliant in that when you go into the store now, it's all Star Wars merchandise.
See, I wish they would do that at Disneyland. If you want something from Batuu and you didn't get it, you have to hele all the way back to the back of the park to get it.
That's the brilliance of what they've done here is that, again, you saw something in Batuu and you're now walking out of the park at the end of the night and you regret it. And it's like you wander into Keystone Clothiers and it's there. It's there again. So you, in theory, Disney's, gives you a second bite of the apple. So you're right. I going forward, especially after Rise of the Resistance opens, I'm going to be genuinely intrigued to see if Disneyland does this. If they pick a shop and, I guess the other problem is frankly, think about it. For the Disneyland version of Galaxy's Edge, you have three different entrances and exits. You've got your Bear Country exit. You've got your mid-trail Big Thunder trail entrance, and then you've got
the Discovery Bay entrance.
And you've got your Fantasyland, old Big Thunder Ranch entrance.
None of which are marked. I noticed at the studios they have signs that point you to Galaxy's Edge. At Disneyland, there is no such animal, and I've seen on more than one occasion people with maps looking confused because they can't find Star Wars land.
To be fair, we were just talking about how Project Stardust is continuing and they're doing that work on that Tomorrowland entrance. So maybe, as they're buttoning this stuff up, we'll see more signage or more to the point, that second bite of the apple thing for Batuu.
I hope so.
But while we're talking about changes in retail, we should mention, in fact, given that we started the show, today talking basically about the International Festival of the Arts at Epcot, Mouse Gear at Epcot closed.
Now, didn't they open a temporary tent Mouse Gear or something today?
Well, no, they actually did something interesting. They have they moved. It's not the same, setup certainly, and it's certainly not the same amazing array of merch. You may remember they had that Glidden paint thing,
right.
And they had that model home. That's the space they moved into. People walk out the door, or
because if you go on Diz Twitter, it's like they opened a tent on the lawn.
Again,
it's Diz Twitter. Liked the name Mouse Gear.
If they can be negative, they'll be negative.
I never thought it fit Epcot very well. I really liked the old name, the Centaurium, rhymes with Emporium. It just had more of a futuristic feel. So I wonder what they're going to call it this time when they open it.
We just talked about the Star Wars merch at Keystone Clothiers, which had a wide variety of stuff that you can find at Black Spire Outpost. But what doesn't it have a wide variety of? Mandalorian merch, specifically the Baby Yoda stuff. Now, Michelle, you guys, of course, have been watching The Mandalorian, which debuted on Disney Plus back on November 12th. And Baby Yoda, the child, quickly became the breakout character from that show.
Right. There's no merchandise.
Yeah, and that's supposedly a deliberate choice. As I understand it, Jon Favreau, the creator of this Lucasfilm Limited series, he wanted Baby Yoda to be a surprise at the end of Chapter 1 of The Mandalorian. That, by the way,
is... Well, it turns out that the lion's share of the leaks about characters that they were getting, that was getting out to the public, was because of toy sales.
Yeah, previously that has been an issue. And face it, you know...
And even you know, people who work for toy manufacturers are leaking pictures of the products months before they're released. Mm-hmm.
So just to be...
And it gives away story beats.
Just to be clear here, what we're dealing with here was not a reprise of what happened with Thinkway Toys back in 1995. For those of you who don't remember, that was when that Canadian-based toy company, all of the major toy manufacturers back in 94, 95 had taken a look at Pixar's Toy Story and said, nah. You know, so so Thinkway was the only one that was willing to take a flyer on Pixar's first film and make toys. And as I understand it, they were only able to, given the limited time, I want to say they cut the deal at what Toy Fair, that event they hold in New York every winter. But there was so little lead up time available to get, you know, the toys designed and then manufactured that they were only able to make 250,000 Woodies and just 50,000 Buzzes, and have those ready out ahead of the original Toy Story, which was released to theaters in November of 95. And all of those toys flew off of store shelves like within a week.
It was crazy.
And
there was some Tickle Me Elmo level stuff there.
Yeah, it was. It was. And do you want to tell the story about David Schiller and Thomas Taffender?
Oh, yeah. They actually, our friends David Schiller and Thomas Taffender actually got hold of a Woody and a Buzz. And the day that the Toy Story Parade debuted at then Disney MGM Studios, they marched right behind the closing rope with those, and they got so many offers. They got so many offers they could have been rich, but no, they decided to hold on to them.
That sounds very much like David and Thomas. What happened? What's been happening with The Mandalorian is different. This was a deliberate decision, by the production team to hold back on the creation of the child products until after the
Which apparently does have a name.
That's
Taika Waititi said.
Yeah, what is it that
it has a name, but
he's going to let Jon Favreau reveal what that is, and
right
when whenever Jon decides that works for the story. So again, no product. In a weird sort of way, this is kind of a throwback to what happened with the original Star Wars movie. Both
when you got the great. Vouchers.
Yeah, they
Christmas under the tree from Santa.
Yeah, the I think they were called the Star Wars Early Bird Certificate from Kenner, which was a polite way of saying, hi, your Christmas present gets here sometime in 1978. Just like what happened in the summer of 77 when 20th Century Fox and Lucas scrambled to get a toy deal in place. By December 27th of this year, Funko, Mattel, and Hasbro all announced that they had Mandalorian toys in the work, specifically child-related items. And there's a 7.5-inch tall Baby Yoda coming from Hasbro, supposed to retail for $24.99, and is supposed to say 10 phrases, which is...
What?
Well, see, now that caught my attention as well, because... Baby?
What does it say? It says,
burbles? I don't know. Did it make a noise before it ate the frog? Speaking of which,
they made one after.
Yeah, I guess so. Speaking of which, though, that this 7.5-inch Baby Yoda talk comes with its own bone broth bowl, as well as a one-eyed frog, I'm assuming, to munch on. Hasbro also has announced that they're producing 6 different Baby Yoda action figures, each of them positioned in a memorable pose from season 1 of Mandalorian.
So like the little resin type.
Very much
they
so.
They don't move, yeah. Right? Not jointed.
Well, what did Kevin Smith call those? Inaction figures?
Inaction figures,
there we go.
That's right.
Okay, so these are aimed at the Star Wars collector's market. They're 2.25-inch high, and they'll retail for $7.99. Mattel, on the other hand, has an 11-inch Baby Yoda coming. That'll have a vinyl head and a plush body. Again, $24.99. That seems to be the price point. In fact, what's interesting is the Disney store also plans on selling an all-plush version of the child. Seen photos of this one, and it's actually a very good likeness of Baby Yoda using fabric.
Yeah. I saw it on Mice Chat, and I was like,
that's nice.
That's really good.
That's really good.
For fabric.
But again, $24.99. Funko, on the other hand, is planning 2 different bobbleheads of the child. There'll be a regular-sized bobblehead. This product's intended for Target and Walmart. Price range, $9.99 to $12.99. I guess, these big boxes will decide what that number is based on demand. But they're already warning customers who pre-order this item that it's restricting sales to 1 per customer. So I think the assumption is that this is going to be a hot toy. And then Funko also has a 10-inch child bobblehead. That one's going to have a $29.99 price point. And it's great. It's great to hear that all this stuff is headed to the marketplace. The downside is everything's being produced overseas, and they're then going to be shipped back to the States on the cheapest possible form of transportation, not the slow boat to China, but rather the slow-moving container ship that's coming from China. They anticipate that the bulk of the stuff starts heading stateside in February, and then won't hit stores shelves till sometime in the spring. In fact, in most cases, these child toys won't enter retail channels till April.
Well, it's still before this new season starts in fall.
This is true. But it's worth noting here that certain Mandalorian items that could be produced quickly, like, say, clothing or print-on-demand items like smartphone cases, magic bands, and magnets, began to appear in the Disney parks within a month of The Mandalorian debuting on Disney Plus. And I don't know if you've gotten to the park to see these in person.
No, I saw on Mice Chat, mm-hmm. they actually have a merchandise columnist, mm-hmm. Natalie Kipper.
Mm-hmm.
She did a really good post about all of the Baby Yoda merchandise, and some of the stuff is great. There's a like a spirit jersey, mm-hmm. but on the front it has that seam across the chest, and it looks like the child is tucked in.
Yes,
to the seam.
Yep, that's going for $69.99, and I want to say,
and it's so cute.
It is cute. So cute. I want to say on the East Coast, that popped up at Mouse Gear back on December 28th. That same Mandalorian spirit jersey is supposedly available in Elias and Company. That's that shop on Buena Vista Street in Disney California Adventure. The very first stuff that showed up in the parks, this was December 11th. The 2 launch bays on both coasts.
The on-demand phone cases.
Right. Those were $29 a piece, $34 if you wanted it personalized. Likewise, I don't know if you've seen the car magnets, the feature Baby Yoda.
I've seen the one that says the child on board that has the little frog on the top.
Yeah, and it's another one that says that my child can levitate your child.
I love it.
Both of those go for $15 a piece, but again, if you want that car magnet personalized, that's an additional $3 charge. East Coast, if you want a magic band.
My child, comma, Rory can levitate your child.
I don't know what to tell you. I'm just providing the information, folks. Okay. Also, East Coast, if you wanted a Magic Band featuring the child, that was available again for the magic number of $24.99. I think that has now officially become the new $9.99, where, you know, if something's $25, it sounds like a lot of money, but $24.99, kind of interesting. They are trying to put out some Mandalorian merch that really is the Mandalorian. For example, on December 14th, the Star Wars Galactic Outpost at Disney Springs began offering a zip-up Mandalorian Bounty Hunter hooded sweatshirt, which comes with removable capes. I don't think Edna Mode would approve of this.
No, she wouldn't. No capes.
Okay, but the adult size is $54.99. The kid size is $46.99. And if you want this one, I understand that Shop Disney is making it available. But again, you get the idea. This is a lot of T-shirts, and there's the on-demand stuff. You being the queen of the of all things tiki, have you heard about this, the child drink that's on the secret menu at Trader Sam's?
Yes, I have. And I've seen pictures of it, and I've heard it's really good.
Okay, so, just walk me through this. So again, the drink itself is supposedly made out of rum and Midori liquor, so that's what makes it green. So how did they do the ears?
Two of the dark cherries.
Okay, well, those are the eyes, but the ears.
And then two limes.
Oh, okay, two limes. And then...
lime segments.
I want to say I've seen a couple of versions where they do a squirt.
They wrap the napkin around the bottom?
Yeah, so that's the robe. But there's also, I forget, there's a red liqueur that sometimes they smear in the glass to make the mouth.
Oh, yeah? No, I hadn't seen that.
Okay, so as I understand it, it's a very sweet cocktail that's pineapple and coconut flavored. Any idea what this costs?
Midori is melon.
Okay, melon flavored. All right, well, again, I'm just telling you what, you know, folks are saying, you know, about the flavors.
So you need to come out here, we'll go and we'll do some research. Very important research for the podcast.
Yes, that will end us up both in the Betty Ford Center. Okay, before we wrap up here talking about Baby Yoda, it's hard for me as somebody who makes a living writing about Disney history to not notice the parallels between The Mandalorian and those Davy Crockett shows that aired on ABC during the first season or two of the Disneyland TV series. I mean, think about it. Both were limited series. Season one of The Mandalorian was only 8 episodes, and Davy Crockett, if you count the 3 that were done for season one of the Disney television show, Davy Crockett, Indian Fighter, Davy Crockett Goes to Congress, and Davy Crockett, The Alamo, and then the 2 additional ones that were done for the second season of the Disneyland TV show, Davy Crockett's Keelboat Race and Davy Crockett and the River Pirates, that's a total of 5 episodes. And even with that limited number of episodes, 8 episodes and 5 episodes, both of them became white-hot pop cultural phenomena. And in both cases, Disney Consumer Products just wasn't ready to meet the public's demand when it came to toys.
No, I think somebody said Baby Yoda to them, and they were like, where do we sign? But you just couldn't. If you wanted to keep it secret.
Yeah, you know, this. But it's so funny that if you look back to 54, in fact, the very first Davy Crockett airs on December 15th, 1954, 10 days out from Christmas of that year. And every little boy, and a lot of little girls, watched that TV show and immediately wanted a coonskin cap. A lot of entrepreneurially spirited Americans were perfectly willing to produce. And in fact, what's kind of interesting is if you think about the number of cease and desist letters that Disney sent out to people, who were, selling their crocheted Baby Yodas through Etsy.
Did they?
Yeah, they the fact that Disney.
Good.
At the same time, it's.
Maybe we didn't see the same Baby Yoda stuff, but the stuff I saw was awful for the most part. I saw one or two good things, but the rest of it was just like,
okay.
Oh.
Okay, well, I saw a couple that
did
were...
Did you take your dryer lint and make that?
I saw a couple that were actually fairly cute. But anyway, Disney did cease and desist letters back in 55. Disney did cease and desist letters in in 2000.
Because I'm still seeing ads for really bad stuff,
but,
or lapel pins of the child to raise autism awareness.
Oh, okay.
I'm like, okay, so what charity does the money go to? Oh no, it's not going to a charity. It's just to raise awareness.
There are always people like that.
There's a reason.
But anyway, other parallels, and this is probably reaching at this point, but face it, you know, music played a big factor in, you know, the popularity of Davy Crockett and The Mandalorian. I mean, the Ballad of Davy Crockett, it was actually on, it was the number one song in America for like 6 weeks, I mean, May 26th through May 14th of 1955. And on the other hand, Walt Disney Records has made the score to each individual episode of The Mandalorian, including, of course, you know, all the work that Bill Conti has done for the TV series, available to purchase, you know, as digital downloads. And I understand those are selling well, but...
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, again...
We don't talk about things like that enough.
Well, we try. You know, and we'll get better at this as the show goes along. But
hey, we actually showed up this time.
That we did. Okay, so 75 years separate these two pop culture phenomenons. Again, Davy Crockett, Indian Fighter, aired on ABC December 15th, 1954, and the first episode of The Mandalorian aired on Disney Plus on November 12th, 2019. So 1 month shy of 75 years. And as you mentioned, on December 27th, Jon Favreau revealed through Twitter that Mandalorian has been renewed for a second season. But again, downside, as you also mentioned, Michelle, that we're not going to see new episodes of this limited series on Disney Plus till the fall of 2020.
You know what that reminds me of? 25 years ago, there was a book put out by a friend of ours, The Davy Crockett Craze.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Paul Anderson did some great
Paul
work.
Paul F. Anderson, yep. That's right. If you have a chance to dig that one up someplace, it's a great read.
Yeah, I would imagine.
It ate the world,
it did.
Culture-wise.
It did.
It really did.
And, you know, might make for an interesting reference guide for certain people at Disney when it comes to what's about to happen next with The Mandalorian. Anyway, Michelle, long story short, probably not the last time we're going to talk about The Mandalorian and Baby Yoda.
I have
Yoda.
A feeling.
Yeah. But,
I sense it in the Force.
Okay, we'll tell you what. If until we record a new episode of I Want That and talk about Baby Yoda, where else can people find you online?
Right now I'm writing a rumor column on Mice Chat and also a little fab news there.
Oh, very cool. Okay. Here at Chimmel Media, we got a couple of other podcasts you might be interested in. Disney Dish with Len Testo. We've got Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor. Marvel Us Disney with the amazing Aaron Adams, gentleman who edits a number of podcasts here. We also have Looking at Lucasfilm with Dan Z. Dustin Fuse and I do a show called Universal Joint about the other theme park. And, of course, the show you're listening to right now, I Want That. Tell you what, if you could do myself and Michelle a favor, folks, and head over to iTunes and rate and recommend this show, that helps get us additional eyeballs and ears. Likewise, if you really, really, really like what you hear, you know, if you could subscribe to Bandcamp, well, that'll make it possible for us to get together $24.99 to buy multiple, you know, Baby Yodas. But again, is that really a thing now? Has $24.99 become the new
$9.99?
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was kind of cool that they were only $24.99 for the Magic Bands, because usually special Magic Bands are $29.99.
I did not know that. Okay. See, you learn things by listening to this show. Anyway, folks, again, I hope you enjoyed listening to this latest edition, and Michelle and I will be back with a new show very soon. Till then, take care.